we're just going to mention a couple of things. We're actually going to pick up on the very verse we left off from last year, but I'm only going to mention one or two highlights in remaining in chapter 9 that are really important, and I can't pass them over, but I'm not going to be covering all the notes. So I will hardly refer to your notes. You have them all there. But I want to mention a couple of things. And Jenny, if you can help me with focusing a little machine. I want to pick up on verse 14, where actually well-known verse, when John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" And there was only one mandated fast in the calendar of Israel, and that was on the Day of Atonement. That was the only day you had to fast, but the Pharisees fasted 2 days a week. And we assume that the disciples of John were fasting 2 days a week, but the disciples of Jesus were not fasting. And so they were a little troubled about this. But of course, the Pharisees fasted for the fulfillment of the prophetic promises. The disciples of Jesus could not fast because they were experiencing the realization of the prophetic promises. And we're in the 10 miracles, matching the 10 plagues of Egypt, and we've got blind people seeing. We've got lame people walking. We've got lepers being cleansed. It must have been a time just of exuberance. And in that context, you cannot fast. There is an appropriate time to fast, and there's a time not to fast. And Jesus' reply is really what I wanted to focus on. The attendants of the bridegroom, notice that word, cannot mourn, Mark says, fast, because fasting was seen as a humbling of oneself. The attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them. Now, there's just something here that we shouldn't miss, because the Bible begins with a marriage, okay? And that marriage of Adam and Eve is a metaphor, okay? It says that in Ephesians. So the conception of biblical truth begins with a marriage. And the consummation of the Bible in the book of Revelation is what? It is a marriage, okay? That was a marriage in a garden, and this, what is called the marriage of the Lamb, is a marriage in a garden. There is a river, there are trees, there's fruit. Happens to be a city as well, is a garden city. And between the two, in fact, making the two possible, and you remember Paul says that marriage, the original one, marriage was a metaphor for Christ and his church, the consummation of human history. Right in the middle is the incarnate Son of God, calling himself, what? The bridegroom, that's right, the bridegroom. And where does Jesus do his first miracle? At a wedding, that's right, because now the bridegroom is come. And because the Son of God, okay, is incarnate, Mary's child, okay, and will go to a cross, he will make that original marriage be consummated in what it's pointing to, that great marriage supper of the Lamb. And really, what is the Bible then about? What's the Bible about? It is a love story. The Bible is a love story. Okay? And you always, when you're reading the Bible, now, my computer has default positions, okay? Okay, when I change various settings, okay, and close the computer down, they kind of, these various settings run back to mommy, as it were, to the default positions, okay? You have these default positions where it kind of, that's where it goes back to. And there is a default position in the scriptures. And that default position is love. Okay? The whole biblical story is a love story. And so when you come to parts of the scripture that you don't understand, the destruction of the Canaanites, okay, if you don't understand, don't worry, just go back to the default position, which is the love of God. Okay? If you're in another section of Revelation and it seems very difficult, seems very violent, and you don't understand it, don't worry. You don't have to understand everything at once. Just go back to the default position, which this is a love story. Okay? That's the default position of the Bible, is the love of God. Always remember that and tell other people that as well. It's very important. So I wanted to mention this a little bit about fasting. But the days will come, Jesus says, when the bridegroom is taken away, and then they will fast. And so now, today, we fast because we want to see the kingdom, not to see the kingdom arrive in the Son of God, but we want to see the kingdom advance so that there will be the eventual return of the bridegroom. Remember, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all nations, and then the end will come. The end will come. And that's why we're fasting now. And could I also say that there's an indication that Jesus is also fasting? Because in Matthew 26, he says, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine again until I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. So there's almost a sense in which our great high priest is on his fast for the kingdom to come and God's will to be done and that great marriage feast to take place. And we join him when we fast. We join our Lord in his fast. Okay, a couple of other things. Mighty Work 8. I want to mention just one aspect of the raising of this girl from the dead. Verse 18 is all I want to read. You remember the ruler came and knelt before Jesus and said, my daughter has just died, but come put your hand on her and she will live. Extraordinary faith. Extraordinary faith. And Jesus said, the girl is not dead, but asleep. And Jesus' description of death is that of sleep. If I can give you that, Jenny, so I can hit my next. And again, you have, I'm not sure on what page, you don't need to look, but you have these notes. The church may have picked up on this, as there are many scriptures that describe death as sleep. 1 Thessalonians, Paul says, I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep. And there are two sides that when we, the last we see of a person, when they've died, okay, and this is kind of from an earthly perspective, is it looks like they're sleeping. Many of you have seen somebody who's died, and it just looks like they're sleeping. Okay, that's from the earthly perspective. If you had a heavenly perspective, They would have departed and been with Christ. Paul says, I would much rather depart and be with the Lord. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So there are two perspectives. But it's rather lovely, this description of death as sleep. Because we all enjoy sleeping, don't we? Some of you are going to have a nap this afternoon. And you don't, when you lay down, you know, and you're just in that twilight zone, you know, you're just kind of, you don't think, oh, no, I'm going to fall asleep. I'm going to resist this. I'm not going to do it. No, it's nothing to be afraid of, although it's very mysterious, because suddenly 6 hours have gone by, not in your afternoon nap, I hope, okay, but in your night's sleep, and suddenly you're kind of back in the world of the living. And death is no more frightening than falling asleep. No more frightening than falling asleep. It's a beautiful description, isn't it? You fall asleep and the next moment. Now, this is a little embarrassing, but recently I cut my toenails, okay? Okay, I just want you to know, you know, that I do take personal hygiene very seriously. And I think it was a little over, well, it was actually about 10 days ago. Don't know if you're supposed to cut them more frequently, but I don't. So, and now, part of Ray Mayhew, I dread to think where those toenails are, okay? Because they were put in the garbage and trucked off to, what do we call it? The city dump, or is that the right word? The city... The landfill. I knew the dump wasn't the right word. The landfill. That's right. And so part of Ray Mayhew is, I don't know what is up against me in the, okay, in the landfill, but there's all kinds of nasty things in there, okay? And a part of me, with all my DNA in it, is in the landfill. But it doesn't worry me, okay? So I don't need it anymore. And so when we fall asleep, that's the body, and it goes into the ground. Nothing scary about that. No more than cutting your toenail, okay? That was part of you that you didn't need anymore. When you fall asleep, okay, to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. You're not worried about your toenail anymore, or the other bits that might be simply awaiting resurrection. But one thing here, one very important thing here, I'm talking about death as sleep because sleep is a beautiful thing, okay? It's not a frightening thing. But the death of Jesus is never described as sleep because he faced the full terror of separation from God. It says in the Creed, he descended into hell. We're not sure what that means. He did not fall asleep so that you could fall asleep. Remove the terrors of death from you. So the death of Jesus is never described as sleep. Ours is to take away the fright and the terror from it. But there's just one other thing I wanted to say about this little girl. Mark adds in the Gospel of Mark, that Jesus said to them, okay, this little girl gets up and perfectly well and I suppose like a little girl running around the room and whatever. And Jesus says, give her something to eat. Now that, to me, is the most extraordinary statement. Here she is, she's been dead, and by the power of God, she is now up, alive, and running around. Why would she need something to eat? I mean, she's full of heavenly life at this point. Well, there's an important truth here, but there are two realms that we talk about, and technically, one is called nature and one is called grace. Jenny's saying, can I move the board? Yes, you can move the board wherever it needs to go. I really should be doing this on the screen, but I just like, if you teach, you just love blackboards or whiteboards, you know. You kind of get addicted to them. So Jeff's going to hold it up now. He's going to go behind it and lift it up so that everybody can see it. Okay, one realm is called nature, and these are the technical. We tend to call, okay, one the natural and one the supernatural. Okay, the technical theological term is one is the realm of nature, one is the realm of grace. We might say one is the realm of the natural, one is the realm of the supernatural. Both are gifts from God. Both are gifts from God. Okay, because nature, okay, or the natural is not really natural because he upholds all things by the word of his power. If there was not the upholding of everything, I guess that the atomic structure of the universe would implode if it wasn't upheld by God. Okay, so nature is not really natural at all. It's supernatural. But anyway, there are two realms, natural and the supernatural. They're both gifts from God. Now, what's happened with this little girl is that God has broken in. Okay, I'll put an S here for the supernatural. Okay, so the natural and the supernatural. God has broken into this little girl's life, and she is now alive and running around. That is the supernatural inbreaking of God. And now the Lord says, give her some food, because he wants us to understand that even when there is a supernatural inbreaking, we still live in the natural world. Now, there's something very important here, because these two realms of the natural and the supernatural, okay, we distinguish between them, but we must never separate them. I'll say that again. We distinguish between them, but we don't separate them, because they're both gifted by God, and even the natural is upheld by the word of his power. Now you say, why do I say all that? Jesus says, give us something to eat. It's simply because we push these realms apart. And we never should. We never should. Notice they are overlapping. Let me give you a little example. Okay, you are sick. Okay? Now there are several ways in which God, in his loving giftedness, will rescue you from your sickness. Okay, it can be what we will call supernatural. You get prayer from the elders or whatever, and you are released from your illness, and you go on your way rejoicing. Okay, and we would say that is supernatural. Or there could have been some research chemist or biologist that God in his grace gave insight to a compound was formed or some antibiotic was formed and you take that, okay? It comes out of, as it were, what is deposited in the earth, out of the natural, and you are well. Now, some people separate those two things. They say, well, you know, I would have really liked God to have healed me. God did heal you. What are you talking about? Both these realms are gifts from God. We distinguish between them, but we don't separate them. Now, when you do that, okay, you don't give this little girl any food. You just say she doesn't need any food. Jesus has been, yes, she needs food, because we operate in both of these arenas. And it's very important for you to understand that. They're both gifts from God. We distinguish between them, but we should never separate them. If we start to separate them, we begin to come unglued in our understanding of how we live God's way in God's world. And that is a very lovely little thing that I think we find here in this little story. A couple of, I think this is the last one. Mighty Work 9, the healing of the two blind men. Verse 27, as Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed him, calling out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David. Have mercy on us, Son of David." And these blind men are the first to call Jesus the Son of David. Men who had no education, could not see, and could not read. And yet they recognized the Son of David. And I just want to put a little diagram up here, because again, there's something very wonderful. There's something very beautiful here. That if we go back to the golden era of Israel, of David and Solomon, we then go through the period of the kings, which is pretty disastrous. And the last Davidic king is Zedekiah. Okay? After that, we have no more Davidic kings. And the years go by, nearly 500 years, and we have a carpenter, Joseph. Okay? And he has a son, well, he's a stepfather to a son, who they're calling a criminal, Jesus, and who will die on a cross. But these men can recognize, and here's the extraordinary thing, that this man, who the Pharisees are calling a criminal and trying to kill, son of a carpenter from Nazareth in Galilee, this man is the son of the great David. They can see that. Now, we know that he will be highly exalted, given a name that's above every name. They don't know that yet, but they have this insight to see who Jesus is. And what's important here is understanding and grasping spiritual truth is not a matter of how mentally acute you are. It's not related to your IQ, okay? Nobody yet had made that connection between this carpenter's son and the great King David. These men who couldn't see, who couldn't read, who had had no theological training, they could see what nobody else yet had seen. And the reception and the understanding of spiritual truth is not related to how acute you are, how intelligent you are, what degrees you have. It's related to the condition of your heart that God can give you understanding and revelation beyond what you can see, because these men couldn't see. But the last lovely thing here is that Jesus touched their eyes, okay? And for social outcasts to be physically touched by the Son of David gave them dignity and restored them to community, because the blindness was seen as a curse by God, incorrectly, but it restored them to community. And then one last thing, and we'll move on to chapter 10. Mighty Work 10, we won't mention. You have notes on that. But the last thing which connects us to chapter 10 is this very well-known verse, known to all of us, verse 36. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Now, this word compassion, as you know, is the strongest word, in Greek for having empathy, for having feelings of mercy, for having a sense of wanting to bring an intervention. It's almost, we say something is gut-wrenching. That's the thought. It's you're moved in the depths of your being. That's the word. Now, what I want to say on this before we move into chapter 10, because this takes us right into chapter 10, is when we track through the Gospels, the word compassion is only used of Jesus, only used of him in the Gospels. Now, it is used in some of his parables, but again, it's being used by Jesus. But when you track it through, you'll find there are five human conditions that move Jesus with compassion as you go through the gospel. Five human conditions. I'll tell you what they are. The first was sickness. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude, is moving up to Matthew 14, and was moved with compassion, and he healed their sick. He healed their sick. And the healing of the sick has always been a great ministry of the church, whether it is by the laying on of hands or the beginning of hospitals. And the hospice movement, the hospital movement, the advancement of medicine was all done out of a Christian worldview. And you need to realize that. Now, name some of the hospitals in Omaha for me, please. Sorry? Emmanuel. That Bergen Mercy. Another one. Methodist. Another one. Well, Lakeside, okay. You just ruined my illustration here, but I'll forgive you, okay. Well, we could say they named it after the Lake of Galilee, couldn't we? We could just say Lakeside. St. Joseph's, okay. And there are a few like, where you work that doesn't have a biblical name, but we'll excuse them. But it's just reflective of the huge impact Christians have had on showing compassion to the sick. The next one that moved Jesus with compassion was hunger. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they continue with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. Today, 23,000 children will die because they didn't have enough to eat. Okay, 23,000 children. And it will be repeated on Monday and on Tuesday and on Wednesday. Now, 9/11, which we've just passed another anniversary, was a tragic event. Okay, nearly 3,000 people died. 23,000 children will die today because they don't have enough to eat. And I'm so thankful there are people in this room, okay, that are working among the poorest of the poor. Gordon and Grace have worked for the best part of 30 years in one of the very, what's Afghanistan, the third poorest in the world, Gordon, somewhere ranking like that. I'm so glad that as a church, we have compassion. We have compassion. And we need to continue that flow and increase that flow if we are to catch the heart of Jesus. The third, interestingly, was bereavement. You remember in Nain, they were carrying out a dead man. and he was the only son of his mother, and she was now a widow. And many people of the city were with her, and when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her. And the Lord is moved, the Lord is moved by untimely deaths. Death was never God's intention for the human family. You were never designed to die. You were designed to live forever by eating from the tree of life. Okay? And death is an intrusion. It's ugly. It's an enemy. And when Jesus saw it, he was moved with compassion. And that's why he will send out his disciples, we'll read it in a minute, to raise the dead. Okay? Now, if we can't raise the dead, okay, sometimes the dead are raised, but if we can't raise them, James says something very interesting, and this ties in with the heart of God, okay, that is moved by hunger, that is moved by bereavement, that is moved by sickness, okay, the heart of God. It says in James, what's true religion in James? James tells you what pure religion is. What is it? To visit the widow and the orphan. I find that an extraordinary statement. Okay? If I was asked to define, okay, what is true Christianity? I'm not sure I would give that answer, that it's to visit the orphan and the widow. It doesn't necessarily say that you've got to be able to meet all the widow's needs, but just the visiting is giving compassion, it's giving dignity, it's validating their loss, it's giving support. And I'm not sure who the orphans and widows would be in our society, okay? In that society, they were the most vulnerable. But it's simply saying that in any society, true religion is looking for the equivalent of the orphan and widow and having compassion on them. And then lastly, the fifth thing that moved out, it's the fourth thing, was alienation. And a leper came to him, beseeching him, kneeling down to him and saying to him, if you will, you can make me clean. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him and said to him, I will be clean. And leprosy was alienation. That was perhaps the worst thing about it. And Mother Teresa made the interesting statements, and of course she worked among the poorest of the poor. She said that there is as much suffering in the West from loneliness and alienation as there is in the East from hunger and malnutrition. It's an extraordinary thing to say. She felt there was as much suffering in the West by loneliness and alienation. And I remember, just a little example, in one of our churches in London, there was a woman in our congregation, and she actually was, if I remember rightly, a widow. She lived alone in a high-rise. It wasn't a high-rise. It was only four levels, I believe. And in England, everybody on Saturday morning goes and shops. I don't know. Jenny does all our shopping. So is that a tradition here on Saturday morning, you shop? You don't. Okay, Steve doesn't, so it can't be a tradition here. And I suppose with shops being open till 9 in the evening or whatever, I still, because coming from England, everything closed at 5:30. I still can't believe that you can go out at 8 o'clock at night and shop. okay? I still haven't crossed that cultural hurdle, okay? I never think there could be shops open at 9 at night. But anyways, in England on a Saturday morning, you go out and shop. This lady went out and shopped. When she came back, she found her apartment was bare. Everything had gone. Every piece of furniture, every possession, it had all gone. A van had pulled up while she was out shopping, and a group of men broke into her apartment, stole absolutely everything, and nobody noticed. Why? Because nobody knew her. Okay? That's sometimes the degree of loneliness and alienation in the West, and it's very painful. That was the condition of the leper, and that's why Jesus is moved with compassion. And then finally, he was moved with compassion when he saw people as sheep without a shepherd. But when he saw the multitude, Matthew 9:36, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. And we live in a society where we've lost our coordinates. Okay? We don't know how to place ourselves, okay, in society. We don't know how to situate ourselves because we've lost our coordinates. They've been blown away, and we're sheep without a shepherd. And Jesus, when he sees that, is moved with compassion. And now, on the back of that, what's he going to do? He says to his disciples, and this closes out chapter 9 and opens chapter 10. He says to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful. Now, Eugene, this was the harvest in Israel. Okay, this was the harvest in Israel, not the Gentile world at this point. The harvest is plentiful. Now, why I want to say that is that we have the conception that almost no Jews believed in Jesus. Now, we know that's untrue because on the day of Pentecost, how many? 3,000. Healing after the healing of the man at the beautiful gate, how many? 5,000. On Paul's third missionary journey, he comes back and he is telling how many Gentiles out there came to know the Lord. And they say to him, yes, and brother Paul, you see how many thousands of Jews have believed. And the word thousand there is myriad, because they didn't have millions or billions. Their largest quantity was a myriad, which was a unit of 10,000. And they put it in the plural. They say, see, brother Paul, how many myriads, plural. And so that's got to be at least 20, 30, 40, 50,000 have believed in Israel. The harvest is plentiful, Jesus says, and therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send forth workers into his harvest field. 9:38, 10:1, and he called his 12 disciples, gave them authority to drive out evil spirits, to heal every sickness, and he will send out his workers into his harvest field, which takes us into chapter 10. Okay, so I'm going to go into chapter 10. I'm going to offer a few questions, which is the second great block of teaching in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 10. This is where we are at the moment. But we'll just take a couple of questions before we move into chapter 10.
I've got one here written.
Okay, please.
Concerning Matthew 9:23-26, in the account in Mark 5 and verse 43, he commands them not to speak about this. What are they commanded not to share?
Okay.
In Mark 5:43, he commanded them to strictly that no one should know it.
Okay. The reference there is sometimes when Jesus did a miracle, you remember he would ask the people, might be cured from leprosy, eyes of the blind open. He would strictly ask them, is the second block of teaching in Matthew's gospel. Now, I'm going to probably not follow your notes, but there's no need to worry because you'll get all the information one way or the other. You can pluck it out of your notes, or you can get some of my extra sheets. But let me just give you an introduction before we read some verses. Okay, well, perhaps we should read at least the beginning verses of chapter 10. Chapter 10, verse 1, he called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. And then we name the apostles. We'll come back to that in a moment. And then verse 5, these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And now we get 42 verses of instructions given to them in this long chapter. Okay, these are instructions to the 12 for their ministry alongside Jesus before his death. Okay, now question, why devote so much space? Now Matthew's writing 30 years later, okay, where Jesus has died, resurrected, ascended, okay, they have preached alongside him, they fulfilled these instructions. Why does Matthew devote so much space to what Jesus said to them 30 years later, when in a sense that aspect was over? Why include it as one of the major teaching blocks in Matthew? A long chapter of 42 verses. And of course, the answer is it must contain principles for the proclamation of the gospel for all ages to merit so much space. So again, eyes down on Matthew 10. I've just read Jesus saying to them, don't go to the Gentiles or to the Samaritans, but rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Look down to verse 17. Or let's go to verse 18. On my account, you will be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. So what we have here is we have a mandate to the disciples to only go at this stage, only go at this stage to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Okay, they're the limits of the mission at this point. But contained within this chapter are principles for the mission of the church to the nations right up to the year 2007 and beyond. There are principles contained in this chapter. And that is why it is so very important. So very important. Let's read, to begin, the list of the people it was given to. Okay, which is verse 2. Verse 2. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who's called Peter, and his brother Andrew. Notice the ands because they're all in pairs. James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Philip and Bartholomew. Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. And so we have the 12. I actually think it says The last pair, okay, is which I read here, which always rather amuses me, is Jesus says, Simon the Zealots and Judas Iscariot. Now, you know the Zealots, okay, were the party who wanted to get out their swords and drive out the Romans, okay? He was a zealot. And I always think the Lord put him with Judas to keep him in line, you know. You know, when Judas was dipping his hand in the money bag, that Simon would begin to unsheath his sword. And it's rather amusing that those two should be put together in this little apostolic team here. But just a couple of things to say about them before we get into these instructions for mission. This is the first time the 12 are listed, okay? We have Peter and Andrew, James and John in chapter 4, but this is the first time for the 12. Secondly, the 12 had a huge symbolic, okay, a huge symbolic importance because Israel began with 12 men. Who were the sons of Jacob. That's right, it began with 12 men. Those 12 men developed into 12 tribes. And when Jesus brings together a community of 12 men, everybody can see that symbolic statement, that this is Israel reconstituted for a new phase. Notice they are all Jews, okay? Just like the first 12 men. The last 12 men is a formatting, as it were, of Israel. And nobody would have missed that. Nobody would have missed that. Peter, James, and John seem to be the inner circle. They were the ones taken into the ruler's daughter's home. The others were left outside. They were the ones at the transfiguration, so on and so forth, an inner circle. They're listed in pairs, okay, reflecting that they were sent out two by two, okay, listed in pairs. Actually mentions them being sent out two by two in Mark, but we know that they were. Why were they sent out two by two? It's a question for you. You ask me questions, I ask you questions. Why were they sent out two by two? Okay. Symbolic, like the ark, because certainly the whole work of Jesus, as I was saying last week, is symbolic of Jesus as is our ark who takes us through the judgment of God. Okay. Any other thought? Why two by two? Why two by two? Yes, yes. Obviously, there are the aspects of there's safety in traveling in twos and so on. You can pray together, fellowship together. But I think the deepest reason is, again, it goes back to the heart of the Torah, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word will be established. And so our Lord is sending them out two by two. Eugene.
Maybe I'm thinking relating to the two tablets of the Ten Commandments, the two testaments, and the proverb says two are better than one. If one falls, the other one can lift him up.
Indeed.
So it's always good to be encouraged, you know, when people try to shoo you away, you know, to have a buddy there with you.
That's right.
So it's a good
method.
Yeah.
There's symbolism going on here that ties again back into the scriptures. It would, of course, have been six mini teams. Six is the creation number, and the kingdom of God is the new creation, the rule of God that's now breaking in the work of Jesus. And so we could say much about that. We have businessmen. We often think of them as peasants, laborers. They had their own business. That's quite clear. with Peter and Andrew, James and John, and so on. A tax collector, a civil servant, a corrupt one who got delivered, thank the Lord. A zealot, political extremist, a traitor. Now, again, there's something very foundational here. This is like Israel being reconstituted, and there had to be a spirit of reconciliation among that diverse group. A huge, even to accept Matthew in, okay, the one who betrayed his own people, meant that this community was a community of reconciliation. And that's why in Matthew 18, okay, where Jesus mentions the church, okay, what is the reason you will be excommunicated from the church? Why? Because you refuse to be reconciled to your brother. Okay, you go alone. You take two with you. You tell it to the church. And if he won't be reconciled, and you see a community of reconciliation that doesn't recognize gender, that doesn't recognize race, that doesn't recognize where you come from socially, okay, that is the community that Jesus is bringing together. And that is why, one of the reasons why, for this extraordinary collection of men. Last two things about them. All men, all Jews, all free, all Galileans, except Judas Iscariot, who came from southern Judea. So it doesn't here seem to be a very radical community, but pretty soon we're going to find women joining the men. And here's an interesting thing that we often forget. In the old Israel, the sign of the covenant was what? Circumcision. That's right. Only performed on man, okay? No female circumcision, which is very brutal, okay, in Israel. Okay, what's the sign, the covenant sign in the New Testament? Yes, by baptism, of course. Baptism is the covenant sign. And are just men baptized? No. It's a new in breaking. It's a new in breaking. Women now come along, as Peter says, as joint heirs in the kingdom. They're all Jews at this stage, but it won't stay that for very long. Gentiles are come flooding in. They're all free, but pretty soon slaves are going to be flooding into the church. They're all Galileans, but pretty soon they'll be Judeans, and there'll be Gentiles joining them. And so what starts out as a very homogeneous group will soon be a very radical community breaking in. Now, the last thing I want to say about the 12 is this is the first church, and it's postured as a missional community. Now, I want to unpack that a little bit, because what we have here is actually Israel was called the ecclesia. You know, the word church is the word ecclesia. And if you read the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the assembly of Israel is called the ecclesia. And now we have, okay, we had the 12. Now we've got another 12 that Jesus brings together, and this is the embryonic ecclesia. And how is it postured? It's postured to be a missional community, going out with the good news of the kingdom. That's how it's postured. And so the first time, the new Israel or the church, and when we say church, please do not hear Gentile. The church began as believing Jews, Okay? So we have, as it were, the new Israel, and it's postured as a missional community. Now, just perhaps quickly, and running out of time here before we can get into the text, I think I stole this from Ralph Winter, who's one of great missiologists of our time. And he speaks of the two structures of God's redemptive mission. Don't know if you can see this at the back, but if you can't, you can get the handout next week if you want it. One he calls a modality, and the other he calls a sodality. Okay, and what he means by that is the modality is the church in its local form. The sodality, these are just sociological terms. Some of you may be familiar with them. Is the church in its missional form. Okay, the one is more static, the other is more mobile. The one is local, whereas the other is cross-cultural. Okay, the one focuses more on ecclesiology, church issues, the other focuses more on missiology, okay, outreach issues, if you like, evangelistic issues. The one focuses on the pastor-teacher, which will go back to something of your question, whereas the other focuses more on the apostle-evangelist. One perhaps would be characterized by James, not the James mentioned here, who will be martyred in Acts chapter 10, okay, but James, the brother of our Lord, who led the church in Jerusalem for many years, the other perhaps characterized by Paul. Now, just to say that both the church, the categories are not watertight, okay? Categories are not watertight. And, sadly, by about 200 AD, the church began to be primarily modalic and pastoral rather than missional. Now, what we have here in Matthew chapter 10 is the first gathering of the new ecclesia, of the new Israel, okay? And it is in this form, okay? Our first presentation of what church is over here. We tend to think the first presentation of church is over here. It's not. It's over here. And it's postured as a missional community. And now, for the next 42 verses, which are going to have to come next week now, okay, are all about us, because we should be postured as a missional community who are sent out by the Lord with the good news of the kingdom, okay, to be agents of change in society. Now, yes, we will be in gathered communities. We are this morning. But the first presentation of who we are, okay, as the new Israel, is we are a missional community. And these instructions, next week, we'll look at them, that were given to the 12 are also given to us. That's why we have this large teaching block. Is not simply for people who are going to Afghanistan, okay? It is for the church who are presented here as a missional community. And so we'll look at those principles next week. They're very important, they're very exciting, and I hope also to nudge into chapter 12, well, at least chapter 11 next week, but we'll certainly cover chapter 10, and I think we'll nudge into chapter 11 as well. So we'll stop it there.